The text is Isaiah 9, 1 to 4, I think. Is that correct? I'm a little at a loss to explain why, I guess it's obvious why these verses, they wanted to get this light and darkness thing in there, which of course is a great epiphany text and a good epiphany theme, something that you can play with. On the other hand, didn't we just do this one? This was, at least a chunk of this, was one of the Advent texts. No, we did this for Christmas, right? This is one of the, I think it's Christmas Eve, as opposed to Christmas Day text. You know, I remember we did this right before Christmas. Now, that's not all bad, I guess, that one connects Epiphany up to texts that you used in Christmas and Advent. In many ways, it's kind of confirmed now what we were doing more predictively. You hate to go over exactly the same ground. But I think the emphasis is a little bit different. Then at Christmas, of course, we kind of, the point of this text is getting to the unto us a child is born section at the end, while here the emphasis is more on these early verses dealing with darkness and light. Now remember, you have the versification problem. In the English Bibles, and I assume the lectionary is based on the English Bible, it says 9:1-4. In the MT, that really starts, 9:1 is in fact the last verse 8. So reading the Hebrew, you have to start at 8:23. We're still not clear. You'll notice that this is a great crux in terms of division of verses. Not only is the chapter division sort of different between English and Hebrew, when you look at verse 23, you'll see that gap between 23a and 23b. Now, that's artificial, but almost everybody follows it. And I'll confess I follow it as a rule of thumb. What you have in the previous section here is a building up of doom and gloom imagery that really flows from the end of chapter 8. We can't go back and deal with all of this now. But Isaiah is essentially makes his speeches to Ahaz in chapters 7 and 8. And if I might sort of summarize the conclusion of that, he kind of says, okie doke, I've said my spiel, I'm going to close up my words, bind up the testimony, and stick it in my pocket or bury it in the ground, and it will be as a witness against you. And it's almost as though I've said my piece, now I'm done. And at this point, Isaiah almost kind of, I don't want to say goes underground, but he sort of retreats from being terribly actively and publicly involved with the Syro-Ephraimite situation. And then kind of concludes with this rather gloomy section that says, frankly, they're not going to listen to me, you see. They will go on their merry way, and it will result in doom and gloom. And if you want to just pick this up at verse 22, and to the Eretz they will look, and what will there be? There will be tzarah, v'cheshika, ma'uf, and tzukah. Man, these are words not easy. Tzara, we know, is distress. Cheshecha is a feminine form of choshek. Choshek's a vocab you probably did have, darkness. This is a feminine synonym. Then you have ma'uf, which probably means gloom, of tzuka, oppression. And afela is another word for darkness. This is usually translated eerie, weird darkness, sort of noonday or midday darkness. A darkness of whatever minuda means. Not easy. Darkness of, I've translated that, banishment. Now, does 23 continue this doom and gloom theme? See? 23 starts, ki lo mu'af. Now, if mu'af is related to the mu'uf right above it, do you see that at least their sound play, whether these words are synonyms or antonyms, is not clear. But mu'uf probably means something more like some eerie darkness or gloom. What do you do with the lo? This is the same problem of lo we encounter, or will encounter, as we did encounter in verse 2 of chapter 9. Do You remember that discussion at Christmas time, whether that lo is the negative word or whether it's an alternate spelling for lamed wow, which would be the prepositional phrase to him. So that you'd read 23a, but for him, for that one who looks to the earth, is more darkness. Or is it, and but there will not be darkness for the one for whom there is hardship or distress. Now, if 23 continues the thought of 22, then this has got to be more doom and gloom. If 23 is the shift to light, then you read the low as negative. And I can't answer the question here, but at least to point out some of the problem and commend you to the commentaries. What you seem to have with 23b, however, is the contrast, and that at least is a clear point in this text, that the doom and gloom of the previous verses now gives way to light and glory. So at 23b, we kind of pick it up here, ka'eth ha'rishon, and this, of course, is 9:1 in the English Bibles. At the eighth, the Rishon, as the first time, hey kal, he kalaled in the hifil, which really means to bring into dishonor. Remember, kal means light in the peel, it means curse in the hifil, it means to bring dishonor. So as at the former time, he brought into dishonor Artsa Zevulon v'Artsa Naphtali. What's odd about this? Can you see the problem? Artsa is obviously from Eretz, but it's got a hey directive on it. Okay? That's not a feminine ending. Eretz doesn't have a feminine ending. So that's the unaccented comment say, and literally means toward a land, Zebulun, and toward a land, Naphtali, though it's almost always translated just as constructs, the land of Zebulun, the land of Naphtali. Why this has got a hate directive on it is less than clear, unless he's talking about sort of this general idea. He caused dishonor to come in the direction of the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. V'ha'achron, this is a contrast to Rishon, two lines up, the achron, the latter time, the end time, hikbith. Hikbith is the hifil of kavath. Kavath is the antonym of kalal. Kalal means to be light, kavath means to be heavy. In the P.A.L., kalal means to curse, and kaveth means to honor. In the hifil, two lines up, the hifil of kalal means to bring into dishonor, and here, the hifil of kavath means to bring into kavoth, into glory. So you got a nice contrast here. At the latter time, he will bring glory, or honor, derek hayam, the way of the sea, ever hayardain, across the Jordan, galil ha-goyim, circle of the nations. Galil means circle, really, from galal to go around in circles. Or you could translate Galil as Galilee, which is what it comes out as in transliteration. That's what Galilee means. Galilee of the goyim. Now, so far, what's the point? Sort of what's the exegetical point here? Why these lands? Again, put yourself in the historical context. These are the lands around the Sea of Galilee, northern Israel, the northern frontier of the divided monarchy. I'm sorry, of the united monarchy, which is now divided. Okay. So on the one hand, he's including the northern kingdom in this prophecy, but agreeing that it was the northern frontier that is, in a sense, the most dishonored. Now, what does he mean by God has dishonored these people? Well, one, I think, is in the background, the whole separation of the north from south, which is sort of a scandal to the Una Sancta. But very particularly, I think, these were, as the northern frontier, the first territories to feel the brunt of an invasion from the north, which is pretty much the only direction anybody could invade Palestine. In fact, these are technical terms that were used by the Assyrians in dividing up the land, all right, as sort of regional, territorial technical terms. So I think the Assyrian conquest is in the background, and essentially what he's saying is those areas that were kind of the first to fall to a foreign invasion will be the areas that sort of first experience the rise or the glory. All right, so it's kind of this reversal, the first to fall, the first to rise. 9:1 or 2 in English. The people, the ones walking in darkness, now we got the regular word for Choshek, Ra'u or Gadol. This line reads pretty easily. And again, now we went over all of this in before Christmas. The people, the ones walking in darkness, have seen a big or. The dwellers of in a land of Tsalmaweth, there's that broken construct chain, the ones dwelling in a land of deep darkness, an or has shined Alehem upon them. Okay, any questions? Again, that reads fairly well. Now, by the way, who are the people walking in darkness? Well, this is probably kind of moving from the particular to the general, anybody, but if there is a particular in mind, it's probably those in Zebulun and Naphtali, these northern territories that are described as those being in darkness. Though, if you go back even one paragraph further in the context, it's all those who rejected the counsel of Isaiah in chapters 7 and 8 whom he has described in that previous section of those for whom there is only gloom and doom and darkness and distress. Right? So it's anybody who's rejected the word of Yahweh. Yet for them, these people, and the consequences of their rejection is people walking in darkness. But they will see a great light. And it's also now that the shift begins to move from north to south. As you know, this text, if you read it all the way through verse 6, ends with the house of David, which is clearly moving the focus to Jerusalem. Verse 2 in Hebrew. I think we talked about this famous text critical crux, and it's the same problem of lo that I think we had in verse 23. Here, Betha, you have made many the goy, not... You have, that was one suggestion as how to read this. It's a very contemporary translation. You have multiplied the joy, not. You have made great the joy, the simcha. Not here can't be the negative. It just doesn't make sense. In the kare, if you do the marginal notation, you'll see that the Masoretes want to read this as to him. You have made many the nation for him. For whom? For him, whoever he is, probably the Davidic child. You have made great the Simcha. They have samacht before you, lifaneka, to your face, like the Simchath ba katsir, like the joy of in the harvest. Another interrupted construct chain. Interesting, that's extremely rare, though it happens, you know, enough that it's not unique. But you've got two instances of it right here in these three lines. They have rejoiced before you like the joy of in the harvest, as they rejoice in their kalaking of the shalal, dividing up of spoil. Shalal is spoil. Verse 3, ki, because the ol of the sibulo, the yoke of his Saval, thing you carry, the oak of his burden, the yoke of his burden, and the mate, the rod of his shechem, of his shoulder, the shavit, the staff of the one being a taskmaster over him. No geish is really used for the Egyptian taskmasters. You have katath, you have shattered, as in Yom Midyan, as in the day of Midian. I think we talked about this last time, that the day of Midian, this is really a conquest motifs, right? The Judges period. which I would say makes two theological points. One, this is the conquest of Israel, what should have been the great and glorious sort of Easter-type victory involving all Israel, not the divided monarchy. And second point, the Midian battle stands out as a good example of how these wars were won not by man's strength, not by might, not by counsel, but by the Spirit of Yahweh. Verse 4, or are we done? Let's see, if we did 3 in Hebrew, that would be 4 in English, and that's really the end of the text, which is too bad. It goes on, as we did before, in 4, to talk about remember, these are the boots for every boot that's shaking and quaking, and the garment rolled in blood stuff will be for fire, will be for burning, fuel of a fire. And then we get to unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given text. Okay. So to summarize, where are we here? Again, the basic motif here is this contrast from darkness to light. And that it applies to people walking in darkness, even as those within the household of faith who have, at least at the moment, turned away from the counsel of Yahweh and chosen a path that leads to even greater darkness, yet for them, the light is still shining. You have this sort of reversal theme that kind of the first to get whacked with the gloom up in the north are also the first to see the glory. And, of course, Matthew doesn't let that go by unnoticed. That these themes now at the beginning of Epiphany, with the beginning of Jesus' ministry and the baptism of our Lord, take place in Galilee of the Gentiles. And that's why Matthew is very quick to cite this passage as fulfilled now in the beginning of the public ministry of Jesus. And that relates now to the joy of all of these motifs that have kind of been on hold since the time of the conquest is the whole point of the kingdom of God being at hand. Okay, Jeff, any questions? Okay, we're... Where are we? Must be in Matthew.